Listen to The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of each month at 11:30 a.m. The Film Show features news and interviews about the local and independent film scene. That's The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of the month at 11:30 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
Have a go. I'd like to be a gallery. Put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream. Have him on my wall.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Emek. He's a poster artist specializing in music posters, and his show is on at the moment, called The Thinking Man's Poster Artist at the People's Art of Portland Gallery in Pioneer Place Mall on the third floor. Welcome to KBOO, Emek.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you for having me.
There are 300 posters in this show, and you've done how many music posters?
A little under 1,000, probably, right, in the past 21 years.
You go in, and they're literally, you know, a few inches apart. There's so many of them, and each one is so detailed and colorful and interesting in terms of the ideas as well as the graphics, that it takes ages to go around this show, and it's just totally absorbing. I had a fantastic time there. We could start with this picture of PJ Harvey, a woman looking into a pool, and she's seeing a reflection of her own skeleton with hair, and the sort of ferns and things growing in the background. That was for a PJ Harvey concert. What was the concept?
This particular piece, she at the time had a lot of songs about water and the ocean and the sea, and I just wanted to kind of play on the Greek myth of Echo and Narcissus and kind of combine those two characters into one, where she's fallen in love with her own reflection, but it's also a reflection of her own mortality. And it's also a play on the fact that when we are in the creative process, we are trying to create something that's lasts longer than we do. Like music and art, we hope they will live on forever. And so this is kind of a very lush scene, but
morbid.
Yeah, morbid, because there's always a dark side to her music and to my art, I guess.
Yeah. So,
but beautiful too.
What goes into something like this? Presumably she doesn't get a great poster for every single show on the tour. Is it the promoter who hands over the money, or how does this thing get made?
Well, that is a good question, because I've been doing this for a while, and I would say every deal is different. So in the beginning, it was a lot of promoter involvement, and then over time, it became more and more someone, I'd say, more directly involved in the band's merchandising department, because they realized that they can make these posters and sell some at the show, give them to VIP guests, use them for radio promotion if you're the so-and-so caller. So they've kind of, the whole process has kind of morphed over the years in different directions.
Right. So you were in LA most of your career. You moved to Portland 8 years ago. Would it be a band's coming through LA and you get wind of it and you like them and you come up with a concept? Is that roughly how it used to work?
Well, I would say that in the beginning, it was a lot about the hustle, that it was me trying to get work. So I would go after bands, go after clubs, promoters, anyone I could show my portfolio to. This was before the internet and before email and everything. So it was a lot of legwork, a lot of phone calls, a lot of going in LA to record companies and trying to get work. That kind of changed, and that's why I moved to Portland, because FedEx and the internet changed everything. So I was like, why stay in LA trying to do the hustle when I can raise my kids in a nicer environment?
Another poster in the show is Ravi Shankar. It's a blossoming lotus with a sitar coming out of the middle of it, and it's sort of turning into some kind of plant. I don't know what you call the shape around it. You know, it's kind of like a window of a temple or something.
Yeah, loosely Hindu Indian motif.
Mm-hmm.
This was for a homecoming show of his in New Delhi with his daughter, who's also an amazing musician, Anushka Shankar. And so I just wanted to pay tribute in the best way that I could. He was, I think, almost 90 years old at this time. He needed help getting on stage, but once he was on stage, he could play amazing, like always.
Right.
And on the borders of the poster, there's kind of little pictures of him throughout his career as a younger musician getting older, and the same with his daughter on the other side.
Yeah.
So all these little details in the background.
Yeah. And just incredible detail. You know, the main shape is a rectangle with sort of a red And then there's a blue, the background of the window shape is blue.
I spent about 6 weeks in India, and I really kind of labored over which red to use for this background, mm-hmm. just to kind of capture the certain feeling that I would get
yeah.
when I looked at the Red Fort or other places in and around New Delhi.
I think of posters as kind of throwaway, you know, but these, you obviously spend a lot of time on them. How did you afford the time?
For me, posters is a total love affair. I live and breathe them because I really love the excitement of getting contacted by someone in the band or management or record company or however the deal comes through. And then you have a very quick deadline to come up with the idea, to submit a sketch, to get it approved, to draw it black and white, pen and ink, usually actual size of the finished product, and then color it, print it, sign it, number it, whatever it be. Mm-hmm. I love that thrill. And so I treat it like an art form. My objective is that I want it to look good hanging on my own wall. And all the great artists that came before me, the whole medium of the posters, I guess, is only about 100 and so years old, from Toulouse-Lautrec and Mucha and all these great poster artists, and then great artists that worked in the silkscreen medium like Andy Warhol and many other artists from that period. And so I feel like I'm trying to create something that, again, will it has the expiration date printed right on the piece, but it is a historical document and an artifact and a commemoration of kind of a tribal gathering. Like, so I'm trying to, you know, make it the best I can. And, mm-hmm. and if it means staying up all night, several days in a row, then that's what it takes.
Yeah. Were you responsible for the printing? Like, would you deliver 1,000 posters or 100 posters printed to the management?
Yeah. Again, every deal is different. Sometimes they want 2,000 posters. Sometimes they only want 100.
Mm-hmm. But you oversaw yes, the quality control
oh, yeah.
to the very end.
I'm a one-man band in a sense. I no longer do the printing myself. I have a friend that I helped start in business, and now he was kind of me and one other friend of mine. He was our exclusive printer, and now he prints for like 100 different people around the country. So he's gotten, the secret is out, I guess. He's a great printer.
What's his machine called?
He's got several machines, and it's trade secrets.
Oh, okay. But these are, ultimately, how are they printed?
They're silkscreen prints. Yeah. So every color is printed one layer at a time, and I have to draw them one layer at a time. I start with my black and white drawing, and then for about 15 years, every color was cut out of film. So if I wanted one area of the poster to be blue, I'd take a piece of ruby lith, mm-hmm. which is this clear film that's kind of reddish in color, and lay it over my black and white drawing and cut away everything that I didn't want to be blue.
So you're cutting with a scalpel.
Yeah, like a number 11 X-Acto blade. And I did that for many, many years. And the little pieces of film would get under your fingernails and in your ears and your underwear and all over the house and everywhere else. And you had to lay every color one on top of the other to make sure that there were no white spaces, that everything had to line up perfectly. And you had to really think about how the poster was going to look when it was finished, because you're basically working in black and white and you don't see how it's going to print until it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And then you always second guess yourself, like, I should have made this part with this color instead. Or
so these films were, are they like CMYK or what
no,
colors are
no,
they?
No, because the great thing about silk screening is that you can make any colors you want. You're dealing with solid pigment paint. So if you want a glow-in-the-dark layer, if you want an actual sparkly gold, if you want a fluorescent, you can do things with silk screen that you cannot do with CMYK. You can actually print on wood and print on metal. And that's another thing that I kind of developed, is how can we print a poster that's still true to what a poster is supposed to be? It can be displayed in the box office window. It could be sold as merch. People can buy it. People can put it on the wall. And yet, how can we do this, or how can I do this without having it be on paper? So I started experimenting with wood, metal, fabric, laser etching, die cutting, resin casting. I have a chapter...
You have a book.
I have a book.
This amazing book, just called Emek, The Thinking Man's Poster Artist, publisher.
Ginkgo Press,
right.
And it's about 300 pages, the first 20 years of my output. Not everything is in it. I have a second book on the way. So I started experimenting with different mediums, and I have a chapter in this particular book about all of the different mediums I've used, kind of crazy, kind of out there stuff.
Like what?
I thought it would be cool to make a poster using only branding irons and printed on wood. So I have a friend of mine in a band called ZZ Top, Billy Gibbons, and I thought that would be a perfect idea for a poster for him, for his band. They've been together 40 years, same three guys. So I called all these different companies around the United States, seeing if I can get custom branding irons made at a reasonable cost, and I finally found a company. And then called cabinet makers to get wood panels, to try to find a couple hundred wood panels at a reasonable cost. And built a giant bonfire in my backyard, heated up my branding irons, and went to town. A lot of my posters start with an idea first, and sometimes that idea will be, then I decide from that idea how I'm going to render the art. If I'm going to do a more bold Russian constructivist kind of World War II propaganda style to draw it, or if I'm going to do a lot of little delicate lines, or if I'm going to emboss it or laser etch it, metal stamp it, print it on fabric, brand it with branding irons. You know, for me, what gets me excited after 20 years of doing this is, what can I do next? What can Right. How can I challenge myself?
Just to be clear, you started out, well, you still do draw things by hand.
Yeah.
Pen and ink. What kind of pen do you use?
Right here.
Oh, you got one right there.
Micron, disposable, but I make them last forever.
What width is the nib?
This is a 01. That's my most common.
And what kind of paper do you draw on?
Sometimes it's illustration board. And sometimes it's just a really heavyweight hot press or cold press, whatever I have lying around. Just big white paper.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't really matter what it is.
Right. I bring this up because the influence I see is R. Crumb, because there's so much detail, and I don't quite know how to describe it, but the little lines and the light coming from one side.
Yes.
And the obvious commitment to spending a lot of time on detail.
Yes, a huge influence. In fact, he even wrote on the back of my book a little blurb from my book.
Mm-hmm. And then the whole coloring it with film, cutting things and getting bits everywhere.
I learned that from Victor Moscoso, who is a famous 60s rock and roll poster artist. I've had the pleasure of meeting all my heroes, all the old 60s poster artists, and discussing process and learning a lot of things, either willingly or inadvertently, just from kind of going to their studios and seeing how they work, because they all worked before computers and I started before computers myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you're the perfect sort of example of someone who's crossed over from the analog to the digital world, and I always love to hear what bits of the analog world you've kept. So now your process is what?
Well, it's still the silkscreen process, which has been around for 100 years, and it's drawing the original art in black and white, and then now I scan it in pieces into my computer in Photoshop, and then I color them one layer at a time. So instead of cutting film, I'll do one layer of everything that I want to be yellow in a poster, and everything I want to be metallic blue, mm-hmm. and it's still different layers. And you're limited by, sometimes by budget, but not so much these days, but by time, because every color in a silkscreen takes an extra day to print, and a lot of times the deadlines are so tight, you have to say, well, they contacted me 3 weeks ago. That doesn't leave me much time to draw it and print it, et cetera.
Yeah. So somebody here in Portland 5 years ago showed you this digital, you know, showed you how to scan and color using a mouse, presumably, or use a tablet?
I started with a mouse, and it was hard. And then my brother, who's an artist as well, he said, you have to switch to a tablet. There's no point.
Mm-hmm.
So I switched to a tablet.
What kind of tablet?
Wacom.
Mm-hmm. Made in Washington.
I don't know.
Yeah, made in Vancouver, Washington, okay. Across the river. You have this digital step, and that's partly to do with your hand, right? Your hands are getting...
Yeah, my hands are getting old. Yeah, I was diagnosed a couple of years ago with the rheumatoid arthritis. So it kind of changed my style a little bit. For better or for worse. Now a lot of my work is made from angry little lines, is what I call them. But they still have a nice visual poetry when I'm finished.
Right. So instead of long sweeping lines, there are small lines joined together.
My dad is an artist. My mom's an artist. My brother's an artist. My sister is an artist. I would say that my style was closer to my dad's when I started. As far as the longer lines.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's more like R. Crumb.
Are they all like commercial artists that make a living doing art?
To take your sentence apart there, they make a living doing art, but I wouldn't say they're commercial artists. I'm the only sellout in the family, I guess. But I chose rock and roll as my passion because or music posters as my passion because it's not selling a product. Like, I would never work for companies, and I do get asked by a lot of companies to try to do artwork for them. And it's, for me, it's about the passion that inspires me when I hear music and live concerts, when people come together, and that whole feeling of seeing a live concert.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to commemorate that, and that's my foray into commercial art. So it's somewhat commercial, but at the same time, bands tell me, do your Emic thing, you know, do something our fan base would like. Mm-hmm. Do it in your style, listen to our music and come up with your own ideas.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Emic, poster artist, whose show The Thinking Man's Poster Artist is on now at the People's Art of Portland Gallery in Pioneer Place Mall, downtown, Southwest 5th Avenue. And it's on the third floor, and it's a show of 300 music posters.
It's an exhausting show. Like, I just look at that show and I think to myself, wow, I'm tired. That's a lot of drawing.
A lot of hours.
Yeah, 20 years worth of hours, late nights, and some originals on display there as well.
There's also a room, a blacklight room, which is amazing. It's just so much fun. People are in there taking pictures of themselves and work.
I think there's some markers in there, some fluorescent markers. You can give yourself like a temporary tattoo that works in blacklight, but it's invisible in daylight. And then there's also another room with light boxes, posters that I made that are on display with lights behind them. Like, I made a poster on actual X-ray film that's printed to look like an X-ray, and that's in the light box room, which is, I think, pretty cool as well.
Anyone who's ever been to Coachella, and that's probably everyone in the KBOO listenership, or at least daydreamed of going there, would know your work because you've done the festival poster for how many years?
I started in 2007. I had an art show in Los Angeles, and the owner of Golden Voice, who puts on Coachella, also the founder and creator of Coachella, he walked into my art show, and he said, at last, I found someone that I think would be a good match for Coachella, and then I've been working for them ever since.
So here's 2010. It's a skeleton of a snake wrapped around, it looks like another lotus flower.
Yeah, it's kind of there's a lot of duality and juxtapositions of things in my work, and it's kind of a metal skeleton. Coachella is kind of like the desert, but they transform it for this festival, and so there's life, and it's protecting this kind of lotus that's about to bloom.
There are an awful lot of skeletons and skulls in your work.
Yeah, that's also kind of using the language of rock and roll, in a sense. I'm kind of fascinated with the mechanics of how things work, so I love the skeletal system. I love machinery. I love the integration of organic and mechanical, kind of the nature of where society is headed with all these advancements in technology, but at the same time, all this refuse left over by things that become obsolete so quickly, and at the same time, the destruction of the environment because of our dependence and pursuit of technology and, everything that it leaves in its wake, the production and the pollution of it. So there is some social content in a lot of my work where I kind of like to explore those themes.
You moved to Portland 8 years ago from LA?
Yeah, once my son was born, we just felt like Portland was a much better place to raise a family.
What did you know about Portland?
I didn't know anything, but my wife had gone to school here in college, and she said, let's go check out Portland. Let's get out of LA. And I said, I agree with you about that, but where to? We visited Portland a few times, and I fell in love. I liked the greenery. I liked nature. I liked coming here. I think one time we came here in spring and it just seemed like everyone was coming out of their houses and working in their yards and planting things. And I liked the parks and I liked the music scene. And at the time I liked all the brew fests and the beer festivals. And now I'm not allowed to drink alcohol because of my arthritis, which is a bummer. That took a while to kind of get over.
And you live in Blue Lake area.
Yeah. Originally, we bought a house closer to downtown, but then I realized that I wanted a big backyard. I don't know, for better or for worse, I decided I wanted to work from home and not have an outside studio. So we wanted to get a house that had some nice views. If I'm going to be stuck at home working, mm-hmm. I wanted to have some nice views. That's what we settled on. And it's a very nice neighborhood and the kids like it.
I mean, it was the digital age that allowed you to leave LA, right? FedEx, internet.
Yes.
You could, all the delivery aspect meant you could be anywhere.
Yeah.
What, when you came to Portland, what kind of benefits were there for your art? But from the new environment?
I'd say on one hand, there were things that I didn't notice at first, but other people commented and said, you know, we notice a lot more trees in your artwork, a lot more clouds, a lot more water. There's new themes being introduced. It's not all so dark. There's a lot more light in your work. So that was kind of a subconscious influence. But also in Los Angeles, there was just a lot of just tension about... As an up-and-coming or struggling artist, about being seen, going to shows, kind of navigating socially, there seemed like a lot of emphasis on that. Whereas in Portland, I felt like I was kind of already comfortable with how I've kind of established myself, and I didn't need to prove anything, and I could just spend time with my family and socialize. I met a lot of great people in Portland. I feel very fortunate. In LA, it just seemed difficult to meet people that didn't have an ulterior motive or an agenda. I mean, not to disparage LA, I have great memories, but in here in Portland, I met some really great people, like the people that run People's Art of Portland.
The gallery, which you helped name. Who runs the gallery? What are they called?
Chris Haberman and Jason Brown, or Jason Brown and Chris Haberman. Don't want to upset any balance there, but they're artists, great artists, and great people. And it's really a community that helps and supports each other. And it's kind of unique because I've worked with or been in gallery shows across the United States, and I really like what I see in Portland.
Is there anything else about the style of visual art in Portland that you've been struck by and that you've maybe even wanted to sort of emulate or copy?
I don't know, because again, we live in a digital age where you can... I mean, yes, there is something to say about locality. But at the same time, we have access to information and visuals from all over the world and from every historical era. So it's kind of a free-for-all in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love Portland's, on a superficial level, the Keep Portland Weird attitude and aspect of a lot of things. Do it yourself. I mean, all of those stereotypes are things that I believe in and agree with. So it feels good to be in an actual area where I have a greater sense of a lot of like-minded individuals.
So, Emmett, you brought in a track for us to hear, or something you listen to while you work. It's called The Richest Man in Babylon, and it's by Thievery Corporation. Let's give it a listen. That was The Richest Man in Babylon by Thievery Corporation. Emmick, what do you like about that?
I find that when I'm working late into the night, Thievery Corporation is like my go-to band for just steady beat and interesting rhythms and message, you know, kind of socio-political messages. And for me, it's a song about, I mean, we're all kind of part of the Babylon system in a way, but, you know, what does it profit a man to gain riches at the expense of his own soul. In general, when I'm working on a piece, I will listen to the band that hires me. I'll listen to their music, and then I'll go to sleep, and an idea will come to me in my sleep in the middle of the night.
What, you wake up?
Yeah, either I wake up and write it down. I don't really sketch it out. It's more like just writing a few notes, like imagine a giant snake made of machinery parts curled around a lotus or something.
Mm-hmm. What do you write it in, your moleskin?
Well, the moleskin got filled up a long time ago, so now it's just whatever scraps of paper I leave by the bed. Yeah, I thought it's kind of normal to get my ideas in my sleep. Mm-hmm. But now when I discuss it with people, they're like, oh, that's kind of unusual. But it happens to me a lot. I get hired by bands, and sometimes I'm not, like, I don't care for their music necessarily, but as an artist that's working, when a band comes to you and says, we're going to pay you money, and you can do whatever you want, and we respect you and appreciate you, as a working artist, that's kind of a pretty good deal. Mm-hmm. Most of the bands that I work with, I do like their music, and I do appreciate them. And in fact, some bands, actually, that I really love have been rather difficult to work with. I mean, a small percentage, so...
What, difficult? You couldn't come up with a good idea or image, or they're just like dealing with people difficult?
Dealing with people. Yeah, it's the people. Sometimes there's some politics or bureaucracy when it comes to getting paid. My parents are artists, my brother and my sister are artists, and it's not about the money. I mean, that's not why I chose this profession. That's not why anyone that I know chose art as a profession. So I hate actually bringing it up in conversation. I do have a love for this medium and for art in general, and that's really what gets me up in the morning and inspires me. It's not all romanticized. There's a business aspect, and you're working with the music industry sometimes.
It seems like you have the perfect career in the sense you have a medium you love, a style of your own. You have a sort of coherence worldview and a set of symbols that are your own. And you fit into an industry in a certain niche. You've moved yourself physically to be where you want. You use the tools that are available now, the digital tools. It seems like a very well-formed package. Now, you're going to tell me you wake up thinking, everyone thinks I'm a phony, or, you know, hating yourself.
That's part of the process. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, what do you want to achieve next?
That's what my parents always ask me. Like, when are you going to grow up and do real art? I don't know. I've never had a 5-year plan. I do this because I enjoy it. And, you know, I remember when I started 20 years ago and people have said, do you think you'll still be doing rock and roll posters when you're 30? And I said, well, I don't know. If it's still fun, then I'll still do it. I mean, the first 10 years was a lot of Top Ramen and celery and peanut butter and scrambled eggs for dinner. That, again, that didn't matter to me. I felt like I enjoyed this, and I don't know what's going to happen next. As long as it's still fun and it's still a creative challenge for me to come up with new ideas and new ways of making things, then this is something I really like. I'm addicted to it.
It's an amazing show. I recommend anyone to go and see it. Go to the mall, get up to the third floor, see it. You'll budget at least 90 minutes because it's just amazing. My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week was Emek. His show is called The Thinking Man's Poster Artist, and it's on now at the People's Art of Portland Gallery in Pioneer Place Mall, and it runs through September the 14th. Thank you very much for coming into KBOO, Emek.
Thank you for having me.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
And now, the KBOO News at Noon for August 26th, 2014. A month-long ceasefire announced last night between Israel and the Palestinian group Hamas is meant to lead toward a longer-term truce in the Gaza Strip. The ceasefire comes after 7 weeks of bombardment in which Israel dropped thousands of bombs on Gaza. The explosive power of the bombs were equal to the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima, according to military analysts. Over 2,100 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli bombardment, around 500 of whom were children. 4 Israeli civilians, including one child, and 64 Israeli soldiers were killed in the assault on the Gaza Strip, which began on July 8th. President Obama is now considering whether or not to carry out airstrikes against Islamic State fighters in Syria. So far, the U.S. has carried out 96 airstrikes against the Islamic State in Iraq, but none have been launched in Syria. The Pentagon has issued an order to plan spy plane missions over Syria to support potential attacks, but it is unclear whether these missions have begun. In other news from the region, an American freelance writer was freed from the Nusra Front after being held captive for nearly 2 years in Syria. Peter Theo Curtis was freed on Sunday after extensive negotiations by Qatar. His release comes less than a week after journalist James Foley was decapitated by the Islamic State.